in the water. The idea that this might have been his mother would haunt the boy for the rest of his life. As Charles Laureat watched the ship pass and descend, something struck his head with shocking force. Whatever the thing was, it slipped back onto the shoulders of his life jacket and caught there and dragged him under. "I couldn't imagine what was landing on me out of the sky," he wrote. "I wouldn't have been as much surprised if the submarine had risen and I had found myself on her, but to get a bolt from the blue did surprise me." He turned his head and saw that the thing that had snagged him was a wire stretched between the ship's two masts. This, he realized, was the Lusitania's wireless antenna. He tried to shake it off, but failed. It turned him upside down and pushed him ever deeper below the surface. Telegram. Friday, May 7th, 1915. 2:26 p.m. SOS from Lusitania. We think we are off Kinsale. Late position, 10 miles off Kinsale. Come at once. Big list later. Please come with all haste. Lusitania. A Queen's End. Only 6 of the Lusitania's 22 conventional lifeboats got away before the ship made its final plunge. A 7th from the port side reached the water, but without a crucial plug. The boat filled and foundered. Those passengers who had already jumped from the ship swam to get as far away as possible, for fear that the ship's descent would generate suction that would drag them down as well. This did not occur, although 3 passengers did experience a kindred effect. One woman, Margaret Guire, a young newlywed from Saskatoon, Canada, was sucked into one of the ship's 24-foot-wide funnels. Moments later, an eruption of steam from below shot her back out, alive but covered in black soot. 2 other passengers accompanied her into the funnel, Harold Taylor, 21, also newly married, and Liverpool Police Inspector William Pierpoint. They too emerged alive, with blackened faces and bodies. As the ship's bow nosed down, its stern rose, exposing its 4 giant propellers, which glinted gold in the sun. By now the Lusitania was 2 miles from the point where the torpedo had struck, and about 12 miles from the old head of Kinsale. In these last moments, the angle of starboard list decreased to only about 5 degrees, as water filled the rest of the ship. Seaman Morton turned onto his back and watched. He saw passengers swept from the deck and hundreds of others struggling to climb toward the stern. The Lusitania again heeled to starboard and slipped from view in a slow, almost stately dive by the head, at an angle of some 45 or 50 degrees. Dwight Harris, floating a good distance astern in his Wanamaker's lifebelt, watched as the ship plunged forward like a knife blade into the water, funnels, masts, boats, etc., all breaking to pieces and falling about everywhere, a terrible mass of iron, wood, steam, and water, and worst of all, human forms. A great swirling greenish-white bubble formed where the ship went down, which was a mass of struggling humanity and wreckage. The bubble got bigger and bigger, and fortunately only came to within 20 or 30 yards of me, shoving wreckage with it. This upheaval was a singular feature of the ship's demise, commented upon by many survivors. The sea rose as a plateau of water that spread in all directions. It carried bodies and masses of debris, and was accompanied by a strange sound. Charles Laureat emerged just as the Lusitania disappeared. By kicking hard, he somehow managed to free himself of the antenna wire. As she went under, Laureat wrote, I was not conscious of hearing cries. Rather, it was a long, lingering moan that rose, and which lasted for many moments after she disappeared. Laureate was overtaken by the wave. The mass of wreckage was tremendous, he wrote. Aside from the people brought out with it, there were deck chairs, oars, boxes, and I can't remember what. I simply know that one moment one was jammed between large objects, and the next moment one was under the water. Countless souls struggled in the sea around him. There was little he could do beyond shoving an oar or some other piece of floating debris in their direction. Many passengers wore heavy coats. Women wore multiple layers of clothing, corsets, camisoles, petticoats, jumpers, furs, and all these quickly became sodden and heavy. Passengers without life jackets sank. The complicated clothing of children and infants bore them under as well. One of the most disconcerting sights reported by survivors was of hundreds of hands waving above the water, beseeching help. But soon, there was quiet. Survivors reported seeing a plume of smoke from a steamer to the south, but it came no closer. The time that had elapsed since the impact of the torpedo was 18 minutes. Seagulls came now and moved among the floating bodies. Captain Turner was still on the bridge as the navigation deck submerged. The sea in the distance was a shimmery blue, but up close, green and clear. The sun penetrating the upper strata of water caught the paint and bright work of the deck as it fell away below him. Helmsman Hugh Johnston saw Turner on the bridge wing, moving from port to starboard and back, wearing a life jacket, but otherwise making no attempt to dodge the customary fate of a sea captain. Johnston said later that he'd never met anyone as cool as Turner. The ship at that point was still moving, but slowly, with a wake full of wreckage and corpses spreading behind it, fed by the hundreds of men, women, and children who through accident or fear had remained on the ship. They streamed off, like the knots in a kite's tail. At 2:33 p.m., the wireless station at the old head of Kinsale sent the Admiralty a two-word message. Lusitania sunk. Observers on the old head had seen it happen. A great ship, present one moment, gone the next, leaving what appeared at a distance to be an empty blue sea. Captain Turner's pocket watch, which would eventually make its way into a Liverpool museum, stopped at 2:36:15. All points. Rumor. The American consulate in Queenstown, Ireland, was located in a suite of rooms above a bar, overlooking the harbor. Behind the building stood the great spire of St. Colman's Cathedral, which dwarfed every other structure in town. That afternoon, Consul Wesley Frost was at work revising his annual report on commercial conditions in various Irish counties when, at 2:30, his vice-consul came pounding up the stairs to report a fast-spreading rumor that a submarine had attacked the Lusitania. Frost walked to the windows and saw an unusual surge of activity in the harbor below. Every vessel of every size seemed to be leaving, including the big cruiser Juno, which had arrived only a short while earlier. Frost counted 24 craft in all. He went to his telephone and called the office of Admiral Charles Henry Coke, the senior naval officer for Queenstown, and spoke to the admiral's secretary. Frost chose his words with care, not wishing to appear to be a dupe of someone's practical joke. He said, "I hear there is some sort of street rumor that the Lusitania has been attacked." The secretary replied, "It's true, Mr. Frost. We fear she is gone." Frost listened in a daze as the secretary told him about the SOS messages and the report from eyewitnesses on Kinsale Head confirming the disappearance of the ship. After hanging up, Frost paced his office, trying to absorb what had occurred and thinking about what to do next. He telegraphed the news to U.S. Ambassador Page in London. Admiral Koch had dispatched all the rescue craft he could, including the Juno, and telegraphed the Admiralty that he had done so. The Juno was the fastest ship available. Queenstown was 24 miles from the reported site of the attack. Most of the smaller vessels would be lucky to cover that distance in 3 or 4 hours. Given the calm air, sail-powered craft would take even longer. The Juno, capable of making 18 knots or 20 miles an hour, could do it in just over 1 hour. Its crew moved with great haste, and soon the old cruiser was underway. But the Admiralty fired back a reply. Urgent. Recall Juno. The order was a direct offspring of the Aboukir, Cressy, and Hogue disaster. No large warship was to go to the aid of victims of a U-boat attack. The risk was too great that the submarine might still be present, waiting to sink ships coming to the rescue. Koch apparently had second thoughts of his own, for even before the Admiralty's message arrived, he ordered the Juno back into port. His rationale for deciding to recall the ship did not conform to the Admiralty's, however. After dispatching the Juno, he explained, "I then received a telegram stating that the Lusitania had sunk. The urgent necessity for the Juno no longer obtaining, I recalled her." This was curious logic, for the urgent necessity was, if anything, far greater, with hundreds of passengers and crew now adrift in 55-degree waters. It testified to the importance the Admiralty placed on protecting its big warships and heeding the hard lesson taught by the Aboukir disaster to never go to the aid of submarine victims. In London, at 4 o'clock that afternoon, U.S. Ambassador Walter H. Page learned for the first time that the Lusitania had been attacked and sunk. But in an eerie echo of the Titanic disaster, initial reports also indicated that all passengers and crew had been saved. Since no lives had been lost, there seemed little reason to call off a dinner party the ambassador and his wife had scheduled for that evening to honor President Wilson's personal emissary, Colonel House. By the time Page got home at 7 o'clock that night, the news from Queenstown had grown darker, but by then it was too late to cancel dinner. The guests arrived and spoke of nothing but the sinking. The telephone rang repeatedly. Each call brought fresh reports from Page's staff at the embassy, which were delivered to the ambassador on small slips of yellow paper. He read each aloud to his guests. The news grew steadily more dire, until it became clear that this was a disaster of historic proportions. The guests spoke in quiet tones and debated the potential consequences. Colonel House told the group, "We shall be at war with Germany within a month." That morning in New York, where the time was far behind that in London, Jack Lawrence, the ship news reporter for the New York Evening Mail, went to a bar on Whitehall Street in Lower Manhattan, frequented by sailors, harbor pilots, and the like, and ordered a gin Daisy, which the bartender delivered to him in a stone mug. Daisy was a bastardization of Doozy. Lawrence saw a harbor pilot whom he knew. The pilot, just back from docking a small freighter in Hoboken, New Jersey, suggested they move to the quiet end of the bar, where he told Lawrence something he had overheard that morning. The pilot explained that he had docked the freighter next to the Vaterland, the big German ocean liner interned for the war. After disembarking, he went to a nearby sidewalk cafe that was full of the Vaterland's crewmen, all clearly in high spirits, slapping one another on the back and speaking animated German. A woman tending the bar, who spoke English and German, told the pilot that the Vaterland had just received a message via wireless that the Lusitania had been torpedoed off Ireland and had sunk rapidly. Lawrence set his drink aside and left the bar. The Cunard offices were a short walk away on State Street. As soon as he walked in, he concluded that the pilot's report had been false. The bureau operated just as it always had, with typewriters clacking and passengers buying tickets. A clerk who knew Lawrence commented on the weather. The reporter continued past and climbed a stairway to the next floor, where he walked unannounced into the office of Charles Sumner, Cunard's New York manager. The heavy carpet on Sumner's floor suppressed the sound of his entry. Sumner was a tall man who dressed well and always wore a white carnation in his lapel. "My first glimpse of him told me that something was wrong," Lawrence recalled. He was slumped over his desk. He looked all caved in. Lawrence moved closer and saw two telegrams on Sumner's desk, one in code, the other apparently a decoded copy. Lawrence read it over Sumner's shoulder. Sumner looked up. "She's gone," he said. It was more gasp than declaration. "They've torpedoed the Lusitania." The message said the ship had gone down in 15 minutes, though this would later be revised to 18. Sumner had no illusions. "I doubt if they saved anybody. What in God's name am I to do?" Lawrence agreed to wait 1 hour before telephoning the news to his editor. 15 minutes later, he was on the phone. This news was too big to hold. The first report reached President Wilson in Washington at about 1 o'clock, as he was about to leave for his daily round of golf. The report bore no mention of casualties, but he canceled his game anyway. He waited in the White House, by himself, for more news to arrive. At one point he left to take a drive in the Pierce Arrow, his tried-and-true way of easing inner tension. The day had begun clear and warm, but by evening a light rain was falling. Wilson had dinner at home and had just finished when, at 7:55 p.m., he received a cable from Consul Frost in Queenstown, warning for the first time that it was likely that many of the Lusitania's passengers had lost their lives. At this, Wilson left the White House on his own, telling no one, and took a walk in the rain. "I was pacing the streets to get my mind in hand," he wrote later to Edith Galt. He walked across Lafayette Square, past the cannon-surrounded statue of Andrew Jackson on a rearing horse, then continued up 16th Street toward DuPont Circle, Edith's neighborhood. He passed newsboys hawking fresh, extra editions of the city's newspapers that already carried reports of the sinking. At Corcoran Street, Wilson made a right turn, then headed back down 15th to return to the White House, where he went to his study. At 10 o'clock, the worst news arrived. An estimate that the Lusitania attack had taken as many as 1,000 lives. That some of the dead would prove to be Americans seemed certain. The thing Wilson had feared had come to pass. As U-20 traveled west, Schwieger took a final look back through his periscope. He wrote in his war log, "Astern in the distance, a number of lifeboats active. Nothing more seen of the Lusitania. The wreck must have sunk." He gave the location as 14 sea miles from the old head of Kinsale, 27 sea miles from Queenstown, in waters 90 meters deep, about 300 feet. What he did not know was that among his many victims were the three German stowaways arrested on the first morning of the Lusitania's voyage. The men were still locked away in the ship's improvised brig. Lusitania, adrift. A life jacket did not guarantee survival. Many who entered the sea had their jackets on incorrectly and found themselves struggling to keep their heads out of the water. The struggle did not last long, and soon survivors who did manage to outfit themselves properly found themselves swimming among bodies upended in poses their owners would have found humiliating. Able-bodied seaman E.S. Hayway wrote, with a degree of exaggeration, "I saw, myself, hundreds of men and women dead with life belts on in the water after the ship had gone." For children, those who did not drown outright, the killer was hypothermia. 55 degrees was not nearly as cold as the water confronted by passengers of the Titanic, but it was cold enough to lower the core temperatures of people large and small to dangerous levels. A drop in the body's internal temperature of just 3 or 4 degrees, from the norm of 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit to 95, was enough to kill over time. Passengers in the water found that their lower bodies went numb within minutes, despite the warm sun above. Those who wore coats under their life jackets were better off than those who had stripped down, for coats and other warm clothing, even though wet, provided insulation for the heart. Thin people, old people, women and children, and especially infants, lost body heat the fastest, as did any passenger who had drunk wine or spirits with lunch. With the onset of hypothermia, those in the water began to shiver severely. As the danger rose, the shivering subsided. With a water temperature of 55 degrees, adults could be expected to experience exhaustion and loss of consciousness within 1 to 2 hours. After this, the skin took on a blue-gray pallor, the body became rigid, and the heart rate slowed to almost imperceptible levels. Death soon followed. Dwight Harris swam toward an overturned lifeboat. The most frightful thing of all was the innumerable dead bodies floating about in the water, he wrote. Men, women, and children. I had to push one or two aside to reach the lifeboat. On the way, he came across a little boy, Percy Richards, calling for his father. I swam to him and told him not to cry, and to take hold of my collar, which he did. The bravest little chap I ever saw. Harris pulled the child with him to the overturned boat and pushed him onto its hull. Nearly exhausted by the effort, Harris climbed on after him. I could hardly move, my limbs were so cold. I must have been in the water about 1/2 to 3/4 of an hour. He spotted one of the ship's collapsible lifeboats, manned by 2 sailors and partially filled with passengers. He called to them. Soon the boat was near enough for Harris and the boy to climb aboard. The sailors picked up 12 more survivors, but had to leave others in the water because the collapsible was on the verge of being swamped. The cries for help from those in the water were most awful, Harris wrote. No ships were in sight. As the Lusitania descended, Margaret Mackworth was pulled along with it. The water around her seemed black, and a fear suffused her of being trapped by debris. She became frightened when something snagged her hand, but then she realized it was the life jacket she had been holding for her father. She swallowed seawater. She surfaced and grabbed one end of a board. At first she imagined it was this alone that kept her afloat, but then remembered that she was wearing a life jacket. When I came to the surface, I found that I formed part of a large, round, floating island, composed of people and debris of all sorts, lying so close together that at first there was not very much water noticeable in between. People, boats, hen coops, chairs, rafts, boards, and goodness knows what besides, all floating cheek by jowl. People prayed and called out for rescue. She clung to her board despite her life jacket. She saw one of the ship's lifeboats and tried swimming toward it, but did not want to let go of the board and thus made little progress. She stopped swimming. She grew calm and settled back in her life jacket. She felt a little dazed and rather stupid and vague, but was not particularly afraid. When death is as close as he was then, the sharp agony of fear is not there. The thing is too overwhelming and stunning for that. At one point she thought she might already be dead. I wondered, looking round on the sun and pale blue sky and calm sea, whether I had reached heaven without knowing it, and devoutly hoped I hadn't. She was very cold. As she drifted, she thought up a way to improve life jackets. Each, she proposed, should include a small bottle of chloroform, so that one could inhale it and lose consciousness when one wished to. Soon, hypothermia resolved the issue for her. Charles Laureate swam to one of the Lusitania's collapsible rafts floating nearby. This was the one that Seaman Morton had seen fall from the ship. Morton swam to it also, as did shipbuilder Fred Gauntlet. Morton called it an oasis in the desert of bodies and people. The three men stripped off its cover. Other survivors clambered aboard. The canvas sides and seats were meant to be raised and locked into position, but with so many terrified people now clinging to the raft, the men found the task difficult. "We were picking people out of the water and trying at the same time to raise these seats," said Gauntlet. "Most everybody that came on board flopped on the seats, and it was practically impossible to get the thing to work properly. We could not get it up far enough to bring the parts home so that they would stay so." They tried to persuade people to let go just briefly so the seats could be raised. "But that was impossible," Laureate said. "Never have I heard a more distressing cry of despair than when I tried to tell one of them that that was what we were doing." They positioned the survivors on the floor of the raft. To Laureate's later regret, he became annoyed with one man who seemed unwilling to move from his seat. Laureate rather roughly told him to get off. The man looked up and said, "I would, old chap, but did you know I have a broken leg and can't move very fast?" With a great heave, the men managed to raise the seats and the attached canvas sides, but only part way. They jammed pieces of wood into the mechanism to prop them in place. The collapsible had no oars within, but the men found five floating nearby. Laureate used one for steering, while Gauntlet, Morton, and two other passengers rowed. Laureate guided the raft through wreckage and corpses, looking for more survivors. Seagulls by the hundreds wheeled and dove. It was startling to see men and women in the water still wearing the suits and dresses they had worn at lunch. The men picked up Samuel Knox, the Philadelphia shipbuilder who had shared Gauntlet's table. They came across a woman who appeared to be African. Seaman Morton swam to get her and brought her back to the boat. This was Margaret Guire, the woman who had been sucked into a funnel and ejected. Laureate wrote, "The clothes were almost blown off the poor woman, and there wasn't a white spot on her except her teeth and the whites of her eyes." He described her as a temporary negress. She revived quickly and brightened the spirits aboard with her optimism and cheer and her bright talk, Laureate wrote. The boat was nearly full when Laureate steered it past a dense jam of floating debris. "I heard a woman's voice say, in just as natural a tone of voice as you would ask for another slice of bread and butter, 'Won't you take me next? You know I can't swim.'" Laureate looked over and saw a woman's head protruding from the wreckage, her long hair splayed over the surrounding debris. She was wedged so tightly that she could not raise her arms. Even so, she had a half-smile on her face, Laureate recalled, and was placidly chewing gum. The men pulled her in and set off rowing toward the lighthouse on the old head of Kinsale, a dozen miles away. Even though the sinking had occurred so near the Irish coast, there was still no sign that rescuers were approaching. Those passengers in the water came to terms with their situations in varying ways. Reverend Henry Wood Simpson of Rossland, British Columbia, put himself in God's hands and from time to time repeated one of his favorite phrases, "Come, Holy Ghost, our souls inspire." He said later he knew he would survive. It is too long a story to tell how I knew, and that this gave him a sense of calm even when at one point he was underwater, asking himself, "What if I don't come out?" He did come out. His life jacket held him in a position of comfort, and I was lying on my back, smiling up at the blue sky and the white clouds, and I had not swallowed much seawater either. For him, these moments in the water were almost enjoyable, aside from the dead woman who for a time floated beside him. "I found it a most comfortable position," he said, "and lay there for a bit, very happily." He pulled the woman's body to an overturned collapsible and maneuvered her onto its hull, then swam toward another collapsible, this one right side up and occupied by survivors. There were corpses on this raft as well. An engineer from the ship started singing a hymn, "Praise God, from whom all blessings flow," Simpson recalled, and noted, "We put a good deal of heart into it." But upon its conclusion, no one tried to sing another. Then we just waited, hoping that they had been able to get out a wireless for help before she went down. It was beautifully calm, fortunately for us, because a very little would have washed us off. We were better off than the people floating on planks in the water, or kept up by their lifebelts, or than the people in the waterlogged boat nearby, which kept capsizing. A porpoise, Simpson called it a monster porpoise, surfaced and played near us, coming up with its shiny black skin and triangular fin showing for a moment. An hour passed, then 2 hours. The sea remained calm. The afternoon light shifted hue. It was a beautiful sunset, Simpson recalled, and all so calm and peaceful. Survivors drifted, in the water, on boats, on pieces of wreckage, for 3 hours, in hopes that rescuers were on their way. Had the Juno come, the wait would have been far shorter, the chances of survival much higher. But the Admiralty had adopted a harsh calculus, and indeed no one knew whether the submarine was still in the vicinity or not. Some passengers claimed to have seen a periscope after the Lusitania sank, and feared the U-boat might even now be among them. As one survivor wrote, "I was fully expecting the submarine to come up and fire on the Lucy's boats, or wait until the rescue ships came up and then sink them." The first sign of rescue was smoke on the horizon, and then came a long, ragtag armada of torpedo boats and trawlers and small fishing vessels, these more expendable than the large cruiser Juno. Here were the Brock, Bradford, Bluebell, Sarba, Heron, and Indian Empire, the Julia, Flying Fish, Stormcock, and Warrior. In Queenstown, suspense mounted. "None of these ships had wireless," wrote Consul Frost. "No news could be had until they returned." Once a lifeboat was emptied, the seamen aboard rowed back to look for more survivors, but as evening approached, the retrieval of corpses began to outpace the rescue of living souls. The last vessel to arrive was a shore-based lifeboat, the Keziah Gwilt, with a crew of 15. Ordinarily the men would have raised sail to make the journey, but there was so little wind that they realized they could cover the distance more quickly if they rowed. And so they did, some 14 miles. "We did everything we could to reach the place, but it took us at least 3.5 hours of hard pulling to get there only in time to pick up dead bodies," wrote Reverend William Ford, in charge of the lifeboat. There, in that gorgeous dusk, they moved through the wreckage. "It was a harrowing sight to witness," Ford wrote. "The sea was strewn with bodies floating about, some with lifebelts on, some holding on to pieces of rafts, all dead." Laureate and company rowed their collapsible boat 2 miles until they came upon a small sail-rigged fishing boat, known in these waters as a fishing smack. As they approached the vessel, Margaret Guire, still coated in soot, saw her husband standing at its rail and called to him. His expression, Laureate wrote, was perfectly blank. He had no idea who this blackened young woman could be. He recognized her only when the collapsible came right under the smack's rail, and he was able to look directly into her face. He wept. It was now 6 p.m. Laureate counted the number of survivors that he and his companions had picked up along the way. 32. 50 other survivors were already on the smack. Before climbing aboard, Laureate pocketed one of the collapsible's oar locks as a souvenir. An hour later, he and the rest were transferred to a steam sidewheeler, the Flying Fish, which then set out for Queenstown. The survivors crowded into its engine room for the warmth. Here was Ogden Hammond, the New Jersey real estate developer. No one had seen his wife. The heat was exquisite, and before very long, reported Arthur Mitchell, the Raleigh bicycle man, songs were being sung, indicating not only a spirit of thankfulness, but even of gaiety. A number of corpses were on board as well. A 5-year-old boy named Dean Winston Hodges, 2 unidentified boys, about 2 and 6 years old, and the body of 15-year-old Gwendolyn Allen, one of the girls who had helped Seaman Morton paint a lifeboat. Dwight Harris helped row his collapsible boat toward a distant sailboat. The going was slow and difficult. Another lifeboat got there first and unloaded a cache of survivors and bodies, then came back for Harris and his companions and put them aboard the sailboat as well. Next, all were transferred to a minesweeper called the Indian Empire, whose crew spent the next several hours searching for survivors and bodies. When the ship began its return to Queenstown after 7 o'clock that evening, it carried 170 survivors and numerous dead. On board, the little boy whom Harris had rescued now found his father, mother, and brother alive and well. His baby sister, Dora, was lost. Theodate Pope awoke to a vision of blazing fire, a small fire in a stove. She had no recollection of the sinking. She saw a pair of legs in trousers, and then heard a man say, "She's conscious." Despite the warmth from the stove, tremors rattled her body. She was in the captain's cabin of a ship named Julia. Another survivor aboard, Belle Nash, later told Theodate how she came to be there. Crew members had pulled Theodate aboard using boat hooks. Presuming her to be dead, they had left her on deck among other recovered bodies. Nash and Theodate had become friends during the voyage, and when Nash saw Theodate lying there, she touched her body and sensed a trace of life. Nash called for help. 2 men began trying to revive Theodate. 1 used a carving knife from the ship's kitchen to cut off her sodden layers of clothing. The men worked on her for 2 hours until confident they had revived her, though she remained unconscious. A lurid bruise surrounded her right eye. There was no sign of Theodate's companion, Edwin Friend, or of her maid, Emily Robinson. U-20, Parting Shot. Later, a woman who claimed to be Schwieger's fiancé told a newspaper reporter that the attack on the Lusitania had left Schwieger a shattered man. The reporter did not disclose her name. When Schwieger visited her in Berlin after his return to base, she had no idea at first that it was he who had torpedoed the ship. All we thought of was that one of the fastest and biggest English ships had been sunk, and we were all very glad, she said. But Schwieger seemed not to share the elation. Of course, his mother and I saw right away that something dreadful had happened to him. He was so haggard and so silent and so different. Schwieger told her the story of the attack. Of course, he couldn't hear anything, but he could see, and the silence of it all in the U-boat was worse than if he could have heard the shrieks. And of course, he was the only one in the U-boat who could even see. He didn't dare let any of the others in the U-boat know what was happening. After the attack, he took the boat straight back to Germany, his fiancée said. He wanted to get away from what he had done. He wanted to get ashore. He couldn't torpedo another ship. The woman's account, while compelling, stands at odds with Schwieger's own war log. If Schwieger felt any sense of remorse, he did not express it by his actions. Just 5 minutes after taking his last look at the Lusitania, he spotted a large steamer ahead coming toward him and prepared to attack. He was supposed to keep 2 torpedoes in reserve for the voyage home, ideally 1 in the bow, 1 in the stern, but this was an irresistible target, a 9,000-ton tanker. Schwieger ordered full ahead to position U-20 in front of the ship, stern first, so that he could use one of his 2 stern tubes. At 4:08 p.m., he was ready. The shot was lined up perfectly, a 90-degree angle with the target's course, at a point-blank range of 500 meters, about a third of a mile. "Conditions for our torpedo very favorable," he wrote in his log. "A miss out of the question." He gave the order to fire. The submarine shivered as the torpedo left its tube. Schwieger waited for the sound of impact. A long silence followed. As the seconds ticked past, he realized something had gone wrong. As periscope is submerged for some time after torpedo had been fired, "I am sorry to say that I could not ascertain what kind of a miss it was," he wrote in his log. "The torpedo came out of its tube correctly, and either it did not run at all or at a wrong angle." He doubted that anyone aboard the steamer even noticed. Schwieger resumed the voyage home. He surfaced to increase speed and recharge his batteries. From atop the conning tower, he saw the smoke trails of at least 6 large steamers in the distance, inbound and outbound, but made no further effort to attack. As it was, this would prove to be his most successful patrol. In the course of traveling a total of 3,006 miles, 250 underwater, he had sunk 42,331 tons of shipping. The steamer Schwieger had fired upon was a British oil tanker, the Narragansett, headed for New Jersey, and contrary to what he imagined, everyone aboard was very much aware of the near miss. The ship's first officer had spotted the periscope, and the captain, Charles Harwood, had ordered a sharp turn and maximum speed. Harwood reported the encounter by wireless. At the time of the attack, he had been responding to an SOS from the Lusitania and had been racing to the scene, but now he suspected the SOS had been faked by the submarine to lure his ship and other would-be rescuers. His telegram, relayed to the Admiralty's war room in London, read, "We proceeded with all possible speed. 3:45 p.m. sighted submarine about 200 yards on our starboard quarter. Submarine fired torpedo, which passed 10 yards astern of us. Maneuvered ship and got all clear. Submarine was seen astern 10 minutes later, 4 p.m. Saw no sign of Lusitania. Believe call to be a hoax." Captain Harwood changed heading and fled away from the last reported location of the Lusitania. Lusitania. Seagulls. His life jacket made him buoyant and lifted him from the bridge, but the descending hull pulled him under. "The whole ship seemed to be plucked from my feet by a giant hand," Turner said. When he came back to the surface, he found himself in an archipelago of destruction and death. Hundreds of bodies were being whirled about among the wreckage, he said. Men, women, and children were drifting between planks, lifeboats, and an indescribable litter. He had done all he could, he believed, and now an instinct to live ignited. He began to swim. He recognized another man nearby, William Pierpoint, the Liverpool police detective. All at once, Pierpoint disappeared. Like newlywed Margaret Guire, he was dragged into a funnel. I thought he had gone, Turner said. But in a burst of steam and hissing air, Pierpoint popped back out, his body coated with a layer of wet black soot that clung to him like enamel. At which point, Turner said, Pierpoint started swimming for home like 10 men, he was so scared. The ship was still moving at about 4 knots, by Turner's estimate. But as he watched, its bow struck bottom. He was sure of it. I noticed it because the sinking of the hull stopped for a few seconds with the stern in the air, quivering her whole length of 800 feet. And then down she went. It was a strange moment for a sea captain. 20 minutes earlier, Turner had stood on the bridge in command of one of the greatest ocean liners ever known. Now, still in uniform, he floated in the place where his ship had been, in a calm sea under a brilliant blue sky. No deck, cabin, or hull in sight. Not even the ship's tall masts. He and Pierpoint swam together. Turner saw the bodies of some of the ship's firemen floating nearby, upside down in their life jackets. He counted 40 in all. Seagulls dove among corpses and survivors alike. Turner later told his son, Norman, that he found himself fending off attacks by the birds, which swooped from the sky and pecked at the eyes of floating corpses. Rescuers later reported that wherever they saw spirals of gulls, they knew they would find bodies. Turner's experience left him with such a deep hatred of seagulls, according to Norman, that until his retirement he used to carry a .22 rifle and shoot every seagull he could. Turner spent 3 hours in the water until he was pulled aboard a lifeboat and later was transferred to a fishing trawler, the Bluebell. Margaret Mackworth's first recollection, after having lost consciousness in the sea, was of awakening on the Bluebell's deck, naked under a blanket, her teeth chattering, she wrote, like castanets. A sailor appeared above her and said, "That's better." She was miffed. I had a vague idea that something had happened, but I thought that I was still on the deck of the Lusitania, and I was vaguely annoyed that some unknown sailor should be attending to me instead of my own stewardess. Her confusion cleared. The sailor brought her tea. With somewhat less chivalry, he told her, "We left you up here to begin with, as we thought you were dead, and it did not seem worthwhile cumbering up the cabin with you." The sailor and 2 others helped her below decks, where she found an unexpected giddiness. The warmth below was delicious, she wrote. It seemed to make one almost delirious. Everyone around her seemed a little drunk with the heat and the light and the joy of knowing ourselves to be alive. We were talking at the tops of our voices and laughing a great deal. She recognized the strangeness of the moment, how it juxtaposed joy and tragedy. Here she was, giddy with delight, and yet she had no idea whether her father was alive or not. Another survivor in the cabin believed her own husband to be dead. It seemed that his loss probably meant the breaking up of her whole life, Mackworth wrote, yet at that moment she was full of cheerfulness and laughter. Captain Turner did not share in the gaiety. He sat quietly by himself, in his sodden uniform. As Mackworth watched, a woman approached Turner and began telling him about the loss of her child. Her voice was low, almost a monotone. She had placed the boy on a raft, she said. The raft then capsized, and her son was gone. In the same dispassionate manner, She told Turner that her son's death had been unnecessary, that it was caused by the lack of organization and discipline among the crew. The rescue ships reached Queenstown long after dark. The Flying Fish, with Charles Laureate aboard, arrived at 9:15, the Bluebell at 11 o'clock. The wharf was lit by gas torches that turned the evening mist a pale amber. Soldiers, sailors, and townspeople formed two lines that extended from the gangway into town. They applauded as survivors came ashore. Other soldiers waited in groups of four with stretchers. Charles Laureate carried one man on his back, the man with the broken leg, to whom he had spoken so rudely. The man proved to be Leonard McMurray, and this was his second shipwreck. He had survived the 1909 sinking of the White Star Line's Republic after a collision in fog with another liner. Laureate's Thackeray drawings and the Dickens Christmas Carol were somewhere deep in the Irish Sea. He sent his wife a telegram. "I saved the baby's pictures," he wrote. "They were my mascot." He closed, "I regret your hours of suspense." Margaret Mackworth learned upon docking that her father was alive. She was dressed only in a blanket and asked the Bluebell's captain for safety pins, but the idea of pins aboard a ship like his made him laugh out loud. A soldier gave her his coat, a British warm. The captain gave her his slippers. She tucked the blanket around her waist to form a makeshift skirt. She found her father waiting at the end of the gangplank. The relief and joy she felt reminded her of that time a month earlier when she had arrived in New York and seen him on the dock. As one of the first survivors to reach Queenstown, he had waited for hours as boat after boat came in, none carrying his daughter. With each successive arrival, the number of dead on board seemed to increase relative to the number of living souls. A friend said later that for a long time after this, the father's face had seemed like that of an elderly man. Dorothy Connor, the spunky young American who had sat at Mackworth's table and had wanted a thrill, came to see her the next morning, Saturday. Connor seemed unruffled, Mackworth recalled. She was still dressed in the neat fawn tweed coat and skirt which she had had on when I saw her step off the deck the day before, and it looked as smart and well-tailored as if it had just come out of the shop. Dwight Harris landed, with his engagement ring and other jewelry still hung around his neck, and his money in his pocket. That night he found a shop that had stayed open for survivors and bought an undershirt, socks, slippers, and pajamas. He found a room in a hotel, which he shared with six other men, and took a huge dose of whiskey before going to bed. On Saturday morning, he bought himself a suit, shirt, collar, raincoat, and cap. While doing so, he happened to notice a boy of about 18 who was asking the shopkeeper if he could have some clothes, even though he had no money to pay for them. The boy looked bereft. Harris volunteered to pay. He learned that the boy had lost his mother. "Poor fellow," Harris wrote to his own mother. "I thank God you weren't with me." When Theodate Pope's ship, the Julia, arrived, a doctor was summoned to come aboard to examine her. Assisted by two soldiers, the doctor helped her down to the wharf and into a motor car, then accompanied her to a hotel. As she stepped from the car, she collapsed onto the sidewalk. The doctor helped her inside. "I was left on a lounge in a room full of men in all sorts of strange garments, while the proprietress hurried to bring me brandy," she wrote. One of the men was the English passenger who, at lunch that day, had joked about not getting torpedoed before having his ice cream. He was wearing a dressing gown. Pink. Theodate drank brandy and was helped to a room. Her face was swollen and discolored. She arranged to send her mother a telegram. One word: saved. She tried to sleep. All night, I kept expecting Mr. Friend to appear looking for me, she wrote. All night long, men kept coming into our rooms, snapping on the lights, bringing children for us to identify, taking telegrams, getting our names for the list of survivors, etc., etc. But Mr. Friend never did appear, nor did Theodate's maid, Miss Robinson. Turner walked ashore, wrapped in a blanket. He spent the night at the home of a local banker. The next morning, in his uniform, he went for a walk. He had lost his Cunard hat and stopped at a haberdasher's shop to buy something to replace it. A survivor named Beatrice Williams, who had also been aboard the Bluebell, saw him and bristled. "You should be worrying about a hat when so many of us have lost everything we own. Why, you ought to be ashamed of yourself." A correspondent for the New York World also encountered Turner that morning and conducted a brief interview. In a cable to his editor, the reporter wrote that the captain appeared stunned. The reporter informed Turner that the bodies of a number of Americans had been recovered, including that of Broadway producer Charles Frohman, with whom Turner had spoken on the morning of the ship's departure. Upon hearing this, Turner seemed to struggle to control his emotions. Tears filled his eyes. Queenstown, The Lost. Of the Lusitania's 1,959 passengers and crew, only 764 survived. The total of deaths was 1,195. The three German stowaways brought the total to 1,198. Of 33 infants aboard, only 6 survived. Over 600 passengers were never found. Among the dead were 123 Americans. Families learned of the deaths of kin mostly by telegram, but some knew or sensed their loss even when no telegram brought the news. Husbands and wives had promised to write letters or send cables to announce their safe arrival, but these were never sent. Passengers who had arranged to stay with friends in England and Ireland never showed up. The worst were those situations where a passenger was expected to be on a different ship, but for one reason or another had ended up on the Lusitania, as was the case with the passengers of the Cameronia transferred to the ship at the last minute. The transfers included passengers Margaret and James Scheinman, newlyweds from Oil City, Wyoming, who suddenly found themselves aboard the fastest, most luxurious ship in service for their journey to Scotland to visit Margaret's family. The visit was to be a surprise. Both were killed. Of the 42 passengers and crew transferred, only 13 survived, among them Miss Grace French, who breezed through the whole ordeal with aplomb. There was the usual confusion that follows disasters. For days, dozens of cables shot back and forth between Cunard offices in Liverpool, Queenstown, and New York. These conveyed a sense of both urgency and surprise, as though Cunard had never expected to lose one of its great ships and to actually have to use its passenger records to tally the living and dead. May 10th. Did Guy Lewin actually sail Lusitania? May 10th. Name Charles Warmy appears on second class. Should this be Charles Waring, which does not appear? Reply quickly. May 11th. Did F.A. Twigg actually embark Lusitania? May 11th. Give us full Christian names and classes, all passengers named Adams who sailed Lusitania. Very urgent. A few passengers reported to be dead were in fact alive, but more often those reported alive were dead. Report of Mr. Billick as survivor is erroneous, U.S. Consul Frost wrote in a terse telegram to Ambassador Page in London. A 5-year-old boy, Dean Winston Hodges, was at first said to be safe, But then came a cable from Cunard to its New York office. Regret no trace of Master Dean Winston Hodges. His body proved to be among those taken aboard the rescue ship Flying Fish. Names of the dead were misspelled, offering moments of false hope.